Hello, everyone. My name is Regis Mensah, and I'm here today interviewing Rabbi Yonah Sclere, who has recently published a truly wonderful book on Yetzias Mitzrayim, The Exodus from Egypt, entitled The Breathtaking Panorama, a sweeping thematic approach to Yetzias Mitzrayim. Rabbi Yonah Sclere, what I'm going to do in the next 30 minutes or so is we're going to talk about your book, about Yetzias Mitzrayim. You bring out many of your ideas through the method of Drash. We're going to discuss what that is. The three founding principles of your book are faith, family, and freedom. And then we're going to tether down those abstract ideas through practical tips for a meaningful Seder. Rabbi Sclere, I need to tell you, you know, the ideas and insights you have in this book are deeply moving. I remember reading it on the plane. I live in the United States, as I was traveling to my parents last year in the UK for Pesach, and the book, it literally brought tears to my eyes because the ideas were so resonant and so true. Yetzias Mitzrayim is one of the first things we learn about when we are children, which is great. The only problem with that is that we carry around that childish understanding with us for the rest of our lives. And what's wonderful about this book is that it enables us to re-examine those childish understandings which we had early on in our lives. And you say in your book you achieved this through Drash. But before we even get to that, I just want to highlight something which is even more fundamental, and that is your attitude to Torah learning in general. On page 334 of your book, you write, and I quote, "Learning should pulsate with the spirit of discovery and the promise of endless possibilities. Fresh and free-flowing, the endeavor can be characterized as play, a core attribute of advanced Torah study. Torascha shashuai, your Torah is the object of my delight," which to me is so interesting because it's clear to me when I attempt to teach my children anything, especially my girls, they have been so conditioned in school to learning everything by rote, everything by heart, that, you know, by the time they get to college, they have to start using their imagination, for example, subjects like calculus. And, you know, in calculus, you have to use your imagination to apply first principles to unfamiliar situations. So obviously, they're not used to that. They're not accustomed to that. So they're completely lost. What is your response to that?
So first of all, Shalom Aleichem, Regis. It is a pleasure to participate in this interview with you. And I am so stirred by your feedback. This is the feedback I am hearing from people the world over. They are telling me the Yetzias Mitzrayim, which they have known from their youth, which frankly, with time, has become old, sterile. All the old vertlach, all the old understandings almost are sprouting whiskers. Well, this book has recast for them a new Yetzias Mitzrayim and brought it alive in a meaningful way. There's a famous mashal, which I love. Men can relate to this directly, and women will extrapolate the feminine equivalent. If you imagine a scene, you'll excuse me, of men at the mikveh, and we all know that locker room scene. And all the macho guys are standing around and undressing, and one fellow, as he takes off his shirt, now takes off his tzitzis, his talis katan, they notice it's the tiny talis katan with the puffy paint, the Winnie the Pooh or Torah Teddy puffy paint. That's not even a shear in halacha. We put it on a child for chinuch. And they say, come on, you're a big boy now. Why are you wearing the Winnie the Pooh talis katan? And he says, well, my mommy got it for me. And they said, well, chap, you'll excuse me. It's time to buy a new pair of tzitzis. You're 35 years old. Tragically, many people's Yetzias Mitzrayim, many people's Torah, is the same as when they were in Torah Teddy, Winnie the Pooh, the Winnie the Pooh phase. And my entire aim in writing this Sefer was to expose people to possibilities that through the power of creative Torah learning, we can bring the old alive with so much newness and make it relatable and inspiring. and really remove some of that jadedness. I think all listeners heard in what Regis was describing in terms of our endeavors to inspire the next generation. There's a certain jadedness. There's a certain sense of being conditioned, disciplined in school. We need to go to school. We need discipline as children. But with time, that makes many of us very, very sterile. And the joy of Torah learning, the play, I have no better way to say it, is lost, and I am seeking to re-inspire this.
In your book, you say that we have to engage in drash because the heart, I quote, the heart craves a sense of newness, a fresh perspective which pshat, the simple meaning of the text, does not provide. My question to you is, what is pshat and what is drash? And perhaps even more importantly, Rashi states famously that he only comes to seek the pshat in the verse. Lo bati elu lipshuto shel mikra. So if it is good enough for Rashi, why isn't pshat good enough for us?
Love the question. And I'm going to hold off on Rashi for a moment because I have a sweeping theory regarding Rashi, which I do not address in my book. My seminary students can tell you I presented about this the last few weeks. I believe that Rashi is by no means limited to pshat. Just to cite you one statement of Rashi, as much as in the off-cited quote which Regis read, he says, Va'ani lo basi el lafarish pshuto, at times he says, Va'ani lo basi lafarish pshuto, ve'agados hamayashvos es hamikra. I am saying pshat, but I am also including agados, midrashim, which smooth out the text. Rashi goes way beyond the purview of pshat, as we see all the time when he quotes exciting midrashim, mind-grabbing, imaginative midrashim, which bring the story alive. When Rashi feels that's necessary to bring the text alive, he goes beyond the purview of drash, and I argue that we all need to do the same as stakeholders in the Messiah to bring the Torah alive to us. We need to embrace drash, as I'm going to define it, to bring the text alive to us. What is pshat? What is drash? So I'm a literalist. Pshat? Let's translate the word. Pshat is from the word pashut, simple. Simple, simply what the text is saying. What it's saying. But how about, when I ask the question, I know what it's saying, but how is it talking to me? How is it inspiring me? How is it touching me? I know Yaakov and Rivka had an exchange at the well. What does that symbolize? What does that represent? How is that going to inform my relationships and my marriage? Once I begin to ask those questions, I'm no longer in the realm of pshat, pashut. I'm going beyond the literal story to address the meaning question. And I believe we live in a generation where the M word, the meaning word, is the big word. We are all seeking, I believe, thirsting for meaning. We don't want more data, more facts in Torah. We've learned enough facts. I want to find meaning. I want a way to find a way to bring my Shabbos alive, to bring my Jewish family life alive. We are all sacrificing so much to live Torah lives and build Torah families. I want to bring it alive. I want meaning. Meaning can only be found in drash. Because let me further explain. As much as pshat on the one hand means the simple meaning, what does drash mean? Drash, my friends, I'm going to argue, is one of the most mischaracterized, misinterpreted, and even adulterated expressions in Torah study. People think drash means sermonizing, as in the rabbi, the preacher, gives a drasha. That is the common usage in parlance, in modern parlance. And people think that means you say whatever you want to espouse a message. You do what you want with the text to get a message across. And we all have a certain skepticism, like, yeah, right, is that really what the Chumash is saying? Some poetic license is being taken on the preacher's part, on the rabbi's part, on the darshan's part. We have this yeah, right skepticism, especially if we were groomed in yeshiva, if we were exposed to serious study, and we learned how to take apart a Tosfos. So we all have that same Jewish skepticism when we hear Avart said, yeah, right. But actually, the word drash does not mean vertlach or airy-fairy musings at all. The literal meaning of the word drash, lidrosh, means to seek. Lidrosh. Seeking means when something is not immediately apparent and you're digging deeper, you're seeking something. You don't need to seek what's staring right at you. The pshat, the simple meaning that Yaakov met Rachel at a well, that's staring right at you. You don't need to seek that. What you need to seek is the meaning. How is that speaking to me? That's what we are all seeking. You know, I love to use the following analogy in my drashos and my speeches and my courses, which addresses both the pshat-drash relationship and, moreover, the question, how can we do authoritative drash rather than the airy-fairy thing? Because students struggle. They ask me, well, we don't want simply the pshat. We want to make meaning out of the stories in the Chumash. But yet it's the pshat which seems so concrete. Once you begin to engage in drash, who says? All our skeptical lights go off. Who says? We need to find a method of drash, a method to find deeper meanings in Torah, which though it's not as concrete as the pshat, it will speak authoritatively to us. So how could we identify this methodology? I use the following mashal, and I speak as a Baltimorean, without casting any aspersions on the city of my youth. There are wonderful people, and our Jewish community is a wonderful, warm, welcoming Jewish community. But unfortunately, there's a crime problem in many parts of Baltimore. In some quarters, they call Baltimore the murder capital of America. Now, at a crime scene, you see Gary kill Joe. Are you a detective in solving that crime? If you see with your own two eyes Gary kill Joe, I don't think you're a detective. You saw he killed him. No detective work. No sleuthing work is necessary. You pull out the handcuffs and you cuff him up. You're not a detective. You're an arresting officer. That's pshat. You saw it in front of your own eyes. No sleuthing, no detective work necessary. But how about if you don't see Gary kill Joe? You just see Joe on the floor in a pool of blood. You don't know who killed him. That's a mystery. That's trash, you understand. You know there's an answer to your question. You know that someone killed him, and it might be possible to find out who killed him in our mashal. Likewise, in our case, you know there's a deeper meaning here. There's more to the text than the simple storyline, but I don't see it. The tools of pshat are not availing it to me. So I need to do the same thing that a detective does. And what does a detective do? And Regis, you as a native Englishman, I turn to you for cultural reference. The greatest detective stories come from your homeland and the tales of
Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes. And I love Sherlock Holmes because what Sherlock Holmes, and for that matter, every detective does, is he doesn't look for proofs. He's not going to have proofs at the onset of who committed the crime. What he looks for is clues. He wants clues. He wants to find indicators that point in a given direction. Now, clues are very indecisive. Initially, is the clue going to solve the mystery? No. The clue is simply an anomaly. Something's out of sorts here. Why is there a glove on the floor? Now, is that necessarily going to solve the mystery? I don't know. But let me note that there's a stray glove on the floor. Right? The same is true when we are engaged in drash. Look for clues. Is there something weird in the text? Does it use expressions that you wouldn't expect? Is there something strange in the storyline? Do you hear an echo or a shout out to another passage in Torah, something which I would call a sister narrative potentially? Right? Two stories that are echoing of each other. Note the anomalies. Note the clues. And with time, you see the clues begin to amass as a pattern. And we all know that scene in Sherlock Holmes, when Sherlock Holmes has his lovable assistant, Watson. And Watson is getting very, very impatient. What do all these clues mean? I just want to know who killed Joe. And Holmes famously says, "Patience, my dear Watson." And in the Beis Medrash and in the classroom, when I engage in advanced drash with my Talmidim and Talmidos, I say, "Let's note the anomalies." And they ask, "But who cares? Okay, there's a stray word here. There's something. What is that going to do for me?" And I say, "My Tyra, patience, my dear. Let's note the anomalies. Let's note the clues. And let's try to internalize it and have it stir us. Because at the end, when the clues come together as a pattern, then we will say in the inimitable words of Sherlock Holmes, "Elementary, my dear Watson," because now it all comes together. Don't you see how all the clues are coming together, indicating Joe killed him? You see the glove, the stray license plate, everything. Likewise, all of these clues are coming together, pointing at us, that say the story of Yaakov and Rachel is really a story about how romantics and practical engineers can learn to get to know each other and bridge their gaps, and we learn about these very compelling issues such as the five languages of love from a Torah perspective and overcoming differences, just to cite one example. Like, this is what Drash, in my judgment, is all about and what makes it really indispensable to bring a text alive.
Beautiful. All right, so, you know what? Let's indulge in some Drash ourselves. And this posit comes from the beginning of Parsha Shemois, Perek Aleph, Posit Tesvov, chapter 1, verse 15. This is the pasuk concerning the two midwives whom Paru speaks to. This is right at the beginning of his campaign against the Jews. The pasuk says, "The king of Egypt said to the Hamyaldot Hoivriot," we're going to discuss exactly who these people are, but both are plural nouns and they are in the feminine, so let us just leave it at that for the time being. The name of one is Shifra, and the name of the other is Pua. So the king of Egypt is clearly speaking to two women. And he says, when you enable the Hebrew women to give birth, and you see the ovnaim, you see the birthing stool, if it is a boy, you shall kill him. And if it is a girl, she shall live. Now, Chazal, Onkelos, Rashbam, and Rashi, they all clearly state that these women are none other than Yocheved and Miriam. Because if you look at the words, Hamyaldot Hoivriot, grammatically, Hamyaldot is a noun meaning the midwives, and Hoivriot is the adjective modifying that noun. So that in colloquial English we would say, the Hebrew midwives. And this, again, this is the traditional translation. However, if we say, as the Kli Yakar says, Hamyaldot Hoivriot actually means Hamyaldot et Hoivriot, then we are drawing a completely different conclusion. We have the wives that caused the Ivriot, caused the Hebrew women to give birth, because Hamyaldot is in the Binyan Piel, so it has a causative meaning. And then again, we have in the very next verse, Bialetchenet Ivriot, and again, I'm going to get grammatical here just for a second, so don't tune out. We have a bet prefix. In Bialetchenet, we have a bet prefix, which means when, followed by the Sharish Yaled, which is an infinitive construct in the PL, which means causing to give birth. And then we have the final letter, the chen, bialet chen, which means, so that chen is a second person feminine plural, you. All right, I'm now leaving grammatical mode. Bialet chen et ivriot, when you cause the Hebrew woman to give birth. In other words, what we take away from all of this is that the midwives were Egyptian. Because as Yehuda HaChassid says, Shifra u'Pua mitzriot hayu mitchila. At the outset, Shifra and Pua were Egyptian women. What happened? Nitgairu, they converted. Dimlochein, because that's not the case, hechtziva otam laharaget hayuhidim. How could Paro possibly have commanded them to kill Jews? What do you say to that, Rabbi Sclair?
So, when you heard Regis's very scholarly and cogent spread of the sources, I am so enamored. I love this. You know why? You ask any school child who were Shifra and Pua, they will tell you Chevron and Miriam. I believe my kindergartner would tell you that. And at the same time, students have told me as they age and start to learn the Chumash, they ask the yeah right question. Yeah right. Shifra and Pua, they're the same as Yocheved and Miriam, and the Chumash vacillates like that on me, calling them Shifra and Pua. Some places Yocheved and other places, like, yeah, right. And unfortunately, they develop a certain cynicism towards Chazal. And this is a classic example of a pshat drash bifurcation. There is no question on a level of pshat, they are not Yocheved and Miriam. The text would have called them that. It is too important a biographical detail to leave out. There is no question on a level of Pshat if you imagine this as a book, if you imagine Parsha Shmos as a book, and imagine a book or a play which begins with a cast of characters. So you'll have Shifra and Pua, and it will speak about their obstetrics background. And you'll have Yocheved and Miriam, the maternal figures in Moshe Rabbeinu's life, his mother and his sister who reared him on his knee. And these are different figures in our cast of characters. No question. Medrash, as it always does, is looking not for facts, but for meaning. I follow Maharal of Prague's approach to Medrash, which believes Medrash need not be understood as a physical depiction of reality. He says Chazal are not concerned with sterile history. Chazal are concerned with meaning, a deeper emes, according to the Maharal. And meaning comes alive through the drama of Medrash. For example, in this case, I develop in the book we discuss extensively, the power of the Nashim Tzidkaniyos, the righteous women in Mitzrayim, who are lovingly engaging with spouse and building family life and nurturing children as much as children are between the crosshairs of Paro. Paro is crushing the babies into bricks. And we begin to understand that raising children is the battle cry of a Jewish people. This is their resistance towards Paro. They resist him not with guns, not with harpoons, not with spears, but with lovingly raising children. Well, how do you bring that alive? How do you bring out that all of the Nashim Tzidkaniyos, who are investing their best in raising children, but most of all, the midwives Shifra and Pua, who under the threat of death, are nonetheless continuing to raise, to facilitate the birth of children. How do you bring out that this is not just a mitzvah, but this is this be-all and end-all. This is the very purpose of Yetzias Mitzrayim. What you do is you say, they are, in a sense, Yocheved and Miriam. Yocheved and Miriam, the mothers of the Redeemer, Moshe, literally nurtured the Redeemer, Moshe. Well, the Jewish women, and most of all, Shifra and Pua, who are engaged in promoting child rearing, ensuring Peshitta Jewish children will live. That was a nurturing of Geula, no less than the nurturing of the physical Redeemers, of the physical Redeemer, Miriam and Yocheved. We are all mothering redemption, nurturing redemption in our dedication to family life. Until this very day, all of us who give raising our children the extra push like Shifra and Pua. It's very hard raising children in the 21st century, especially in a society which tells us that children are a burden. Children are a drain, and yet we're giving our best to raise these needy, but very lovable, I must say, neshamas, right? And when we're involved in all the muck and all the gook and cleaning diapers and many other unpretty tasks, and as they get older when they talk back to you and all those other sordid things, realize from a Torah perspective, you are involved in Geulas Yisrael, the perpetuation of the Jewish people. Those who put out their necks to raise Jewish children are nurturing the redemption of the Jewish people no less than Yocheved and Miriam, who literally mothered the Redeemer. That is my interpretation of the drash, what comes alive through seeing these nurturing figures, Shifra and Pua, as no less than Yocheved and Miriam. From a deeper spiritual perspective, they are Yocheved and Miriam. This is an excellent example of how drash brings the theme of the Pshat alive. Now, when we're young children, we think unidimensionally. You can't expect a young child to deal with two levels of truth. There's a physical truth. There's a conceptual truth. A child, did it happen? Did it not happen? So as children, we need to teach Medrash as this is the truth. They are Yocheved and Miriam, right? And I must put in a plug here for traditional Jewish education. There are certain well-meaning educators, primarily in Eretz Yisrael, who want to, in their mind, sanitize education from drash. They want to just teach pshat. They're well-meaning. I know many, several of them. But what they don't understand is when you teach pshat without drash, the story does not come alive in a child's mind. It's just a sterile story. It does not impact their neshama. It's drash which brings the story alive. But however, the Bali drash, we're never expecting that we remain tethered to our childish understanding. They never thought, remember our mashal before, about my friends in the locker room. They never thought I'm still wearing those puffy paint tzitzis, which my loving mother gave me when I first was toilet trained and put it on. They never expected I would still remain. They realized, and when you become an adult, you're going to study. There's a pshat, there's a drash, there's a literal truth, there's a conceptual truth. But many of us have not been able to outgrow that. And that is what I see as the purpose of my book, showing us how mature and creative re-experiencing of the most well-known of stories, Yetzias Mitzrayim, we will see how the Torah speaks to us in an adult, mature way.
That's beautiful. As I mentioned at the top of the interview, your book on Yetzias Mitzrayim is based on three principles: family, faith, freedom. And what is clear from our previous discussion is that these women, whether we say they are actually Yochevet and Miriam, or whether we say they were Egyptian women who converted, the verse, the pasuk says about them, that these women, they feared Hashem, but also and they did not do as Paro had, as the king of Egypt had spoken to them. Rather, what? They enabled the children to live. So they were clearly deeply courageous women who were prepared to defy the king of Egypt, whatever the consequences might be. So I think this segues into the subject of family, and of course, an important subheading in the category of family is feminism, or to be more precise, Jewish feminism. What, in your opinion, Rabbi Sklar, is the role that the Torah wants a Jewish woman to play?
So this is a beloved theme to me because of the impactful role of some of the women in my life. My dear mother, who taught me emunah, who taught me love, who taught me to be a loving person through her milk, through nursing from her. My dear wife, who's a partner in all of my endeavors, who's one strong and capable woman. In the development of the Yetzias Mitzrayim story, what becomes apparent is Jewish femininity is a glorified role. It was never about submission. I mean, just think about the Shifrin Puah, who Regis was just referencing. They were engaged in the highest form of resistance. But what form of resistance were they engaged in? Not resistance with rifles, resistance to nurture, resistance in love. You see, I believe, and I will throw out a disclaimer, let the chips fall where they may. I know in some modern day quarters, we are told that any binary perspective is asur, is wrong. But you know, there are some concrete truths. Not all of life is relativism. Men and women, from a Jewish perspective, from a Kabbalistic perspective, are different, different personalities. Mikubalim believe that we each have a certain male and female inside. It's simply a question of dominance, so no one should be surprised if they find both inside. It's not a fluke of birth. You're a healthy male. You're a healthy female. The other side is a complementary aspect. We're talking about dominance. And Torah sources see a woman as a characteristic nurturer. And I love to bring this out from the very first woman. The very first woman, Chava, is called Chava from the word Chai, alive, because she's Ein Kol Chai. She's the mother of all life. Now, we all know that Hebrew. But, you know, I just threw out to my seminary students last night. I asked them if they know the name Chava in English. And these are all yeshivisha girls. So it was considered a major cusp of intellectual sophistication that many of them knew. Yeah, Eve is Chava. Okay, and then I asked them, okay, I said, okay, did you ever study advanced language arts? They kind of fidgeted around. I said, okay, do you know what the Latin root of Eve is? Because all Western languages depend on understanding the Latin root. And I said, the root word of Eve is the same as vibrant, vivacious, environment, survival. V is the root. What does the V root mean in Latin? And vibrant, vivacious, survival, or my favorite, the French expression, joie de vivre. V means life. And the Latin actually was accurate. It picked up on the meaning of Chava as Eve. She is life itself. Life itself does not simply mean physical life. Life means vibrancy, chias, joie de vivre, joy of life. femininity in Jewish thought is all about life and joy. You see, we men, if I may be so blunt, can be very boring. We can be engaged in the nuts and the bolts. But at the end of the day, screws and screwdrivers are boring. It's meaning we human beings want. It is the female. It is the trait of femininity which tells us, nurture something from this. Whatever the experiences in life, you're on an outing as a family. So beyond simply the view which you're taking in, the animals which you're petting in the zoo, but what is the meaning behind it? Let's make life out of it. Let's nurture meaning from this. That is the characteristic feminine trait. Women nurture. They nurture souls and they nurture meaning from things. And I believe you will find even in the modern era, when women are engaged to a large extent in the same practices as men, the nurturing soul really doesn't change. You will find this in the office. We all have good women coworkers and the like who are nurturing, whether they mother all of us, they ensure that a project with a classic devotion and commitment beyond professional duty, they are nurturing, they are mothering, but more than that, they always bring the joy, the life into a project, the meaning into a project, and never allow a project to remain screws, nuts, and bolts. This nurturing role is the most glorified, the most beautiful, regardless of its playground, regardless of its domain. Even if a woman chooses not to be engaged in the public square, say to become an educator, or say to be a housewife, or whatever it might be, to be a mother, or if she, as many of our great women today, are juggling multiple roles. And I must tell you a plug, because I'm married to one. Jewish women today are more than Wonder Women, right? In the secular world, they tell you, yeah, she's a Wonder Woman, because with her 1.2 kids and a cat, she is balancing soccer responsibilities and opera with her husband. And give her a pat on the back, and she should get a pat. But she doesn't stand a candle to Jewish women and in many cases, a job, demanding children, a husband who needs attention. The Wonder Women, regardless of their life decisions of how they want to express this trait, the power of the nurturer is colossal. And I develop in the book how the prominent women in the story, such as Miriam, the nurturer, are no less redeemers, according to Chazal, than the visible actors, Moshe and Miriam, Moshe and Aaron. Moshe and Aaron might physically lead the Jews out of Egypt, but it would be a sterile redemption if it was a redemption which wasn't over meaning. And the meaning of Yetzias Mitzrayim, in my judgment, is family life. So really, I do not struggle with the question of feminism, because I see when we own and personalize the traditional perspective of Jewish femininity, it's a glorified nurturing role, which I want every Jewish woman to be proud of, and I want us all to be proud of.
I want to follow that idea. Just remember the nurturing aspect of the Jewish woman, and perhaps the slightly staid nature of man in general. There's been a growing movement in the last 10 years or so to have halachic yuatzot, female halachic advisors, so that, for example, women can approach other women about issues, for example, concerning intimacy, so that they don't have to speak to a male rabbi about these issues. How do you feel about this development?
So just for clarification, I am not going to weigh in the halachic determination, because some leading authorities have given opinions, and both for institutional reasons, various institutions which I'm associated with, and for other reasons, I do not see it as my role to give definitive rulings, but I will present a perspective. The fact that halachic determination is a classically male role is in line with the male psyche. Talmudic learning is classically male. That does not bar that many women are capable of Talmud learning. But Talmud learning is characteristically male. I have found this in my own teaching. In various settings, I have had women who are Talmidos and attend my Machshava Shiurim, my Jewish philosophy and Drash Yerum, and then attend my Gemara Shir and say, you know, in institutions which allow that, and I always allow the rabbi or the Rosh Hashiva of the institution to make decisions. I'm an Evan Neman, I'm a Paul Neman. And they always tell, 9 out of 10 times, they tell me, Rabbi Sklar, it doesn't speak to me. There always are exceptions. It doesn't speak to me. They say it's too technical. I think this goes back to the nurturing nature. Women care about meaning. Women obligate us to look for meaning rather than to focus on technicalities. Men, in a cold, clinical way, can rule on a technicality, and I'm going to say it in an emotionally detached way at times. You have halachic decisions which are brutal. 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 A couple which is denied physical contact during a most sensitive time, or a couple who's not allowed to get married, or other matters, a marriage which is ruled halachically forbidden, and there's almost an emotional detachment and which has to be applied in this ruling, which is characteristically male. I would not want an emotionally detached woman. That would rob her of her nurturance. So what I'm going to argue is like this. Without discussing how given communities decide to deal with the issue, there is a very relevant issue here, and that is women require feminine companionship. I would dare say we all require feminine companionship. But all the more so a woman when she's dealing with sensitive gender and relational subjects, there is an innate discomfort in dealing with a man who's an outsider. There ought to be, because of our pride and sneas, a certain discomfort. And she can only find what she's seeking in a woman mentor, a friend, a rebbe, a mentor. And even if she's correctly seeking male halachic guidance, she needs the complementary role of the feminine input. There is no question. I would like to advance the suggestion that regardless of what participation this female mentor does or doesn't have in the actual halachic process, that female mentor is indispensable to what I'm going to argue matters even deeper than the halacha, and that's the neshama. How does one cope with nida? How does one cope with separation? How does one cope with a husband who's not in sync with a wife's needs? How does one, right? There is no question, and regarding all the sensitive physical and emotional and physiological aspects, women need to be provided with qualified feminine mentorship. And the fact that in given communities, due to halachic sensitivities, there are certain determinations of what the male role is in the halachic process that should not exclude the indispensable role which a feminine mentorship towards a woman who is experiencing these very visceral and real and sensitive areas of life.
Let's move on to the second pillar of the book, faith. The Jews have now left Egypt 6 days previously, and they are marching in the desert. If you can just picture this in your mind's eye for a moment. They're marching in the desert, and suddenly, Vayisu v'nitzar es einehem, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, v'hine Mitzrayim noseya achreihem, and they see the Egyptians coming after them. Vayirum oed, they were very fearful, v'yitzaku v'nitzar el Hashem. The Bnei Israel, the children of Israel, they cried out to Hashem. Why are they so petrified? It's because in this particular chapter in Bishalach, the chapter repeats the phrase over and over again, that phrase which scares the living daylights out of them, Kol sus rechav paro farashov. They see all the horses and all the chariots and all the horsemen of Paro bearing down on them. In other words, in that one moment, after all the miracles, after Esrei Makos, fine, they thought maybe the Egyptians will never going to see them again. They're not going to be stupid enough to come after again, yet again. And yet, when they see those horsemen, those chariots bearing down on them, they again remember the crushing superiority of the Egyptians as represented by those horsemen and chariots. They remember their technical mastery, and they remember the Egyptian sophistication. And so they cry out to Moshe, Mazdei Sosi Solonu, what is this that you have done to us to bring us out here? On October the 7th, the shoe was on the other foot, because Israel has long boasted of itself as a place of great technical innovation and sophistication on a per capita basis. It has the most technology startups of any country in the world. And yet, our enemies were able to deceive us so easily using the most basic technology. That wall around Gaza was supposed to be impregnable with all sorts of technological innovations. And they were able to cut through that just with box cutters. And they drove their motorcycle through the holes. And for pretty much the remainder of the day, communities in the south of Israel were calling for the IDF to come to their aid, as our enemies carried out the most horrible and savage acts against us. What is your response, Rabbi Sklar, to Mazos Asisolanu?
The Mazos Asisolanu. What have you done to us, Moshe? And in a deeper sense, what have you done to us, Hashem? What have you done to us, God? Is precious. That is the precious question from the deepest pit of our neshama. You see, faith, emuna, which Yetzias Mitzrayim is the story of, the mother story of, faith is largely when we operate from the vulnerable position. Hashem showed himself to us, so we built up a certain reservoir of faith when the going was good. We saw the love, we felt the love. He took us out of Mitzrayim, or in the contemporary examples, we had a thriving community in Eretz Yisrael. But then, as always happens, the going gets rough. There's a pendulum to life, this way, that way. And in life, you know, I love to use the metaphor. Life, have you ever gone tubing before? Have you ever taken your children tubing? Tubing down a stream. Now, in that stream, sometimes the water is calm and it's so pleasant. Sometimes there are rapids. And sometimes it's churning, right? There's one constant throughout. Hold on to your tube. That stream is life. Individual life and national life of Yisrael. There's this stream called life, Olam Hazeh. Sometimes the waters are pleasant. Sometimes we feel the love. But be assured, there will be rapids soon. And sometimes it will be churning. And all we have left is to cling on to that raft, that one constant, and that is Emuna. Hashem, I saw you during the blissful times. I know you're still here, but for reasons known to you alone, now I live amidst the rapids, so I cling on ever tighter. And clinging on to Emuna, by the way, is connecting to Hashem even when you're arguing with him. The Jewish people argue here. Mazos Asinulanu, but ultimately at Yam Suf, as Chazal note, Vayetzaku, they cry out, they talk to Hashem. Hashem, we Jews are too invested with you to part ways. Even when we are moving through choppy waters, we will continue to dialogue with you. We will continue to relate to you through the difficult times. We will cling on to Emuna. We will not pull away from you. I believe even a so-called Jewish atheist, the fact that they are so obsessed with the God question, and I've heard them, they won't move away from the issue. Okay, he doesn't exist. He doesn't exist. You believe, what do they say? He's the big spaghetti man in heaven. Okay, move on. Why are you so obsessed with a spaghetti man? Because deep down, it's too much a part of their Yiddish and neshama. We Jews are a people who believe that life, there's more to life than meets the eye. I am not just a conglomeration of cells somewhere in this black hole Milky Way. There's something more to all of this. And that, of course, points to the God question, whether you want to use the word or not, right? It's when the going gets rough, in the Mazos Asinu moments, where we show Hashem. Even when the going gets rough, we're clinging on to you as a figure in our life. Even when we're angry, even when we're stormy, even when we're upset, Hashem, nothing will drive a wedge between us in terms of you are a party in our life. That is what Emunah is all about. That's what Yetzias Mitzrayim is all about. Yetzias Mitzrayim is a beautiful moment at the inception of Jewish history to always be revisited, not because it's the norm. Life as we know it today before Mashiach comes is largely not redemptive. You look on the cover of my book, that panoramic picture of the Yam Suf. That is not the life which I'm living. I am largely moving through churning waters. We are moving, we live lives of bullying, rejection, disappointments. That's the real life. But you know what Yetzias Mitzrayim gave us? Yetzias Mitzrayim, the good moments in your life, when you felt the love, and I hope all of us had this to some degree in childhood. There was a certain bank account, hopefully, of positivity. Your parents raised you. There were positive experiences. There's a certain fundamental belief that I am beautiful, my reality's beautiful, and therefore, even when the going gets rough, I know there's beauty here, which ultimately means there's Hashem here. And therefore, in the difficult moments, I turn back to the Yetzias Mitzrayim moments and the personal Yetzias Mitzrayim moments, the goodness in my life, to therefore deal with the struggles I face.
I think that's exactly right, because I think the parallel with certainly with Kriyas Yam Suf is that there might have been all sorts of bickering about what we should do at the edge of the water. But once Kriyas Yam Suf occurs, we go through and we read about the wonderful miracles that happened in the actual Yam Suf. When they get to the other side, there is total unity amongst the Jewish people to the extent that they sing this beautiful song, the Shirat HaYam. And I think that's applicable to today as well. After this terrible, terrible tragedy, there is, you know, just maybe a split second, there is almost total unity amongst Am Yisrael after such a horrible event. So I think that there are many, many parallels between, you know, Kriyat Yam Suf and what happened on October 7th.
Yes, very powerful. I will share with the audience, some of you I'm sure read, a widely disseminated article which I wrote. I wrote an article in Mishpacha magazine under the title, Not in Hashem's Name, A Torah View on Religious Violence. This article spurred a tidal wave of response, and there's a second article which is going to be published this week, Parshas Pekudei, a follow-up article on my part. The article deals with the entire question of a loving conception of God. And it begins with really the Hamas monsters, who in the name of religion are killing in the name of God. And I ask the question for my Jewish psyche, which finds it so strange. To me, religion elevates man. Religion, emunah, makes me more loving, makes me an ever more godlike person. Conceptualizing and wrapping my head around those who want to murder in the name of God, like how I deal with that. And I discuss a teaching from my great Rebbe of Nachum Lansky, the great Mekubal and thinker and Lamdan here in Baltimore, where he asserts from a Kabbalistic perspective that one who claims to believe in God, but their conception of God is either a spiteful one, a cruel one, or one which provokes them to be cruel towards others. They have so, you'll excuse me, bastardized, adulterated Hashem, who to our greatest conception of Hashem is as Tovu Meitiv, the loving, good one. When one's vision of God is fundamentally cruel, as in a vision which promotes cruelty, that is so anathema to Hashem in Judaism, says Rav Lansky, such people are not really worshiping Hashem. They're worshiping the Sitra Achra. They're worshiping some sanatonic force, the force which opposes Kedusha that they visualize. That's really idolatry. That's really not worship of God. It's monotheism only in name, as in worship of one. But it's the one is not God anymore. The one is Sitra Achra. And I talk about this whole idea, the inverse model which we have of a loving God, and how even the difficulties in life are really opportunities to cling close to his love. This provoked such a wonderful response. I was flooded with response. The magazine published a few letters, and then my personal email was flooded with responses, people telling me this is the big issue in our life. In some cases, they said things like, if only I was raised with this concept of Hashem, it would have saved me years of therapy. Where were you 25 years ago? Or I'm still trying to unlearn the wagging finger of from on high, which I envisioned in my youth. This is the big, big issue, a loving conception of God, which, as I discuss in my article this week, we own up to the difficulties in life. It's harsh. We don't always feel the love, but we could still cling to it because we've built up a sufficient emotional bank account of positivity during the good times. We have an account now to draw on, a font, a reservoir of faith to draw from, cling on to the love when the going gets rough.
Right, Claire, I want to get to the third pillar of the book, which is freedom, because The American nation was founded through documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights. These are documents that emphasize the importance of the individual in society. So my question is, how can a me generation embrace Yahadus as personally fulfilling, as opposed to restrictive? And I want to add another element to this question, because with other prophets besides Moshe, they couch their prophecy in rich imagery. If you read the prophecies of Yeshaya or even Yitzchak in Bereishis, we see that there's rich imagery there. Yitzchak says, Mishpani Haaretz, Tal HaShemayim. But when we come to Moshe Rabbeinu, the reason he's able to receive his nevuah, his prophecy, so clearly is that he's able to speak to Hashem panim el panim, face to face, is precisely because he has no ego. So again, how is it possible that people who are so self-absorbed can find freedom in a Torah way of life?
So Regis and I, as old friends here, we have a certain personal understanding in this conversation, because we had a conversation several days ago. You know, I'll be honest with you. I am an unabashed American on my father's side. We are from the rare stock of Litvisha Jews who have been in this country since the 1880s. And I'm still religious today and a Rav. That's amazing. That's a miracle within itself. On my mother's side, we have Holocaust victims and the like. But the point is, I am thoroughly American. And for, you might say for better or for worse, but apparently my destiny in this life is to relate to Hashem as an American. Now, Regis is an Englishman. And Regis, I think we all hear his colossal intelligence and perspective. You know, he really told me in an unvarnished way how Americans such as myself, we are self-absorbed and we have lost contact with the notion of devotion to something larger than myself, whether patriotism. And I relate to this deeply, specifically in the case of Avodah, specifically in the case of religion. You know, it seems to me that you had Jews in previous generations who were motivated by duty. I said every word in the Machzor. Check. Now, I would ask them the question. Did you understand every word of the convoluted piyut there? I mean, how can you engage in a verbal exercise reading it? They would look askance at my question as a 21st century Jew. They would say, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. Duty was a motivator. I cannot understand it. And that is because I'm a 21st century American. I want to own that and not engage in a quality judgment of who's better, my ancestors, my great-grandmother, or myself. We have a different avoda based upon the world we were raised in. I want to find an approach how a me generations, my generation, can own Yiddishkeit proudly. It's not going to be duty. We Americans believe in self-fulfillment, self-advancement. We are smart enough to know that self-advancement requires discipline. You're not going to achieve anything in life of meaning unless you're goal-oriented and disciplined. You're not going to receive a college degree or any higher degree if you don't work hard and discipline yourself. Of course you need to discipline yourself. But discipline must always be in the pursuit of self-fulfillment. My vision of Yiddishkeit is we trust Hashem, not simply that his system is a good one, but his system is one which is going to bring out the best in me and give me personal fulfillment. If I develop my davening and get up early in the morning and work on Kavanah and Tefillah, I am going to find how this hallowed text, though it is universal in nature, speaks to me. I am going to find how raising a Jewish family, and to the outsider, you know what the cruel canard is. You're all doing the same thing. They call us penguins. You're all dressed in black and white, and you're all doing the same thing. Do you know my relationship to my wife is as unique as we are? And as different as anyone else here. And my relationship to my children brings out the best in me and the uniqueness of self. My Torah learning, I learn Torah in a fashion which is not generic, but which is unique to me. I observe mitzvahs in a fashion. But this requires a lot of work. If you don't have drash, if you don't have the ability to develop something deeper in Torah, it's going to seem sterile. But if you invest the effort, good personal drash, you're going to find a way how tefillin speak to you, Shabbos speak to you, and in terms of our subject, how a Pesach Seder speaks to you. So I develop in the book in my freedom section that Pesach is man cheruseinu, as much as we are assuming new responsibilities. And an outsider might say, what sort of freedom is that? You're leaving Paro and now you're assuming subordination to Hashem. It's just simply changing one slave master for another, albeit Paro's an evil tyrant and God's a benevolent dictator. But you're an abbot, you're a slave. And I say, oh no, my God is not a benevolent dictator. He's benevolent, but he ain't a dictator. He is here to nurture me, just like a loving parent, as we develop in a book, the book. A loving parent is an authority figure. We are not ready to give, assume the be your child's friend thing. I'm an authority. I am here to nurture my child, but I'm here to nurture them. I'm here to bring out the them and their individual needs. That is Hashem. Hashem is here to bring me out. And that's why a deep Judaism is liberating. It brings out the me. It brings out the me. Regis, can I bring out one last example of this? And that relates to one of the Seder protocols. What is the most well-known Seder mitzvah or behavior, one which we all have deep childhood associations with, which even non-Jews know? Manashtana, asking the Manashtana. The asking of questions. Why is asking of questions so significant at the Seder? And just to bring out the point, Chazal tell us that even if you're in a Seder all alone, you need to ask yourself the questions, then answer your own questions, right? What is this fixation on questions? After all, we all know what the answer is going to be. Certainly, if you're answering your own questions, you know what the answer is going to be. What is this fixation with questions? Certainly, in the idealized Seder of parents and children, what is the power of questions and answers? So I discuss in the book, think about a slave nation, a nation which had been exposed to cruel tyrants. Was there any concept of asking questions? Do as I say. Don't open your mouth. Do as I say. Asking question is anathema to a slave master. Yet as parents, we welcome questions. Let's think about that a moment. Do you welcome questions? Ha ha ha. It's 8:30 at night. The toddler's still up. Brush your teeth, sonny boy. I don't want to. Why do I need to brush my teeth? Now I'm beginning to vacillate a little bit. Why welcome that question at 8:30 at night? But joking aside, you know why we parents welcome questions? Unlike the tyrant. The tyrant is really not interested in what the subordinate feels. They are here to have their will done and have the subject implement their will. But do you know, as a parent, I am not really here to ensure task performance. Do you know, if my child brushed their teeth tonight, but did not learn anything about the importance of hygiene or personal responsibility, I failed as a parent. If I did not convey to them that hygiene is important, to use the toothbrushing example, but I won, I made sure through the power of Mike, because I'm stronger, right? He or she brushed their teeth. I was not a good parent, because, you know, as parents, we're not here to ensure task performance. We're here to impart values to nurture the child to be the best self. Right? That yes, there need to be rules, there need to be regulations because I'm the authority and the child doesn't yet understand, but I'm here to forge them, to nurture them. This is why questions are so precious. I believe Yetzias Mitzrayim redeems the very notion of authority figures. That when we bond with our children at the Seder and we're engaged in question and answers, what we're really telling them is, I want to hear your question. I want to hear what's on your mind. I am here for you. I will confide something personal in you. I've written a book on Yetzias Mitzrayim. I have a lot to say on Yetzias Mitzrayim. Do you think at the Seder, I am going to darshan at the Seder? I could do a good job. But you know, I'm not sitting down at the Seder to give shir. I'm sitting at the Seder to bond with my children. So I want to hear what's on their mind. I will use the wealth of Torah development that's in my soul and my brain to respond to whatever is on their mind, but it's going to be a child-calibrated discussion. I'm going to allow them to take the initiative in that respect. And that's really what freedom is. That is how I envision Hashem. That is how I envision Hashem. Hashem is the authority figure, but do you know, he also welcomes my question. And if I may share one final vart, which I mentioned in the book, that brings this out. The Manashtana, that expression, ma, is clearly drawn from the text itself. The Chumash describes how the children, the four sons, ask their father a question of Ma Havod Hazos, Mazos, that Ma is a powerful term drawn from the text itself. Well, at the end of the Haggadah, you recall Rabban Gamliel's discussion about the Pesach Matzah and Mar. When we use that same word Ma, and we say Matzah Zushanu Ochlam Al Shema, Pesach Shehoyu Avosin Ochlam Al Shema, we ask the Ma question regarding Hashem's mitzvah. Now, hold on. You know why we eat matzah on Pesach? Hashem said so. Close your mouth, subject. I mean, that's what Paro would have said. But yet Hashem, I ask, of course I'm going to eat the matzah whether I understand or not. I'm not deviant, but I won't understand. What message do you want to get across to me, Father in Heaven? How powerful it is that we use that same verbiage, ma, which as children we addressed our parents with in the beginning of the Seder, to then at the end of the Seder address our Father in Heaven because we want that sense of intimacy between parents and children. That trust that you're here to nurture me as an authority figure. You're not here to dictate by fiat to me from your high horse. And think about those Egyptian horses, which we just portrayed with such evocative imagery before. That is how we address Hashem. And a final drash clue, which I bring to back this up, is in the opening story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is the Bris Bein Habsarim, the covenant between the parts when Hashem develops the trajectory of Yetzias Mitzrayim with Avram. It says, your children will be slaves for 400 years. Well, the story opens, believe it or not, with Avram questioning Hashem. Avram asks Hashem, how do I know that I will inherit, my children will inherit the land? Right? What term does Avram Avinu use in the opening to Bris Bein Habsarim, and by extension, the opening to all of the Exodus story? Ba-ma-eda. That term, ma, literally leaps off the page. The first ma, the first, in a sense, manish tana, begins with questioning the divine. Avram understood Hashem wants me to ask questions. He wants me to ask the ma question. And thus, the die of all of Yetzias Mitzrayim is cast. It's about the ma question. As children, our parents welcome questions. As parents, we welcome our children's questions. We are here to nurture them. That's why Judaism is freeing. Our Father in Heaven wants the ma question. So, I live in the me generation, but you know, a Torah Chaim provides the access routes for each generation to develop an entire Torah view which speaks to them. And my contention that I could find self-fulfillment in every part of Torah, I see Hashem as the authority figure who's evoking the me. I think we have an entire perspective here that we could own for ourselves as 21st century American Jews. This is why Judaism provokes Cheirus. This is why Zman Cheirus Seinu makes a Seder meaningful. Let's bond close to our children at the Seder and enter their minds and provide for them the wealth of the Masorah perspective on their wavelength.
I want to end with the words of the Netziv from his wonderful Perush Hamek Davar, where he says on his explanation of the mitzvah of tefillin in Parshas Bo, he says that the telling over of the story of the Exodus once a year on Seder night is not sufficient. Therefore, we need a daily remembrance. In his words, he says, let me just quote, because he says it much better than I can, Gam ze eino maspik adayin kol ha-torech. This in and of itself is not sufficient, namely just one Seder night a year. Arkein yelecho le'ois l'zikaron b'chol yom. Therefore, you should have for yourself a sign and a remembrance every day. V'harizek kamo she'ha'adam misaper livno. And this is like a father who's telling it over to his son. Inyan gadol le'torech musar. An important moral lesson. V'chakach b'chol yom maskiro b'kitzur v'remez. And then afterwards, every day, he reminds him in an abbreviated way and through allusion. Tuchunat hasipur, the outlines of the story, ad shuv moed hashana, until that Pesach Seder night comes back the next year. Va'az misaper ot hapam barichut, and then he explains. He goes over that story again at length. That's exactly what Hashem commanded, that after we've said the story over at length, on Seder night specifically, and on Pesach in general, La'asot ksharim alze, to make knots for this, b'chol yom, every day, b'yad uvarosh, on the arm and on the head. Why those two particular places? Because they are the makom hishtabdut, halev hamoach, because they are the places of subjugation of the heart and of the mind. In other words, it appeals both to the emotions and to the intellect. So it's clear that from the Netzis point of view, and I think pretty much everyone else, Seder night plays an important, central, and pivotal role in the Jewish calendar. What are some things that a person can do to make his Seder as meaningful as possible for the whole family?
Well, I have to underscore my previous message. Relate to the children on their level, their wavelength. The challenge in running a Seder is the divergence of personalities, temperaments, ages, maturity, and we want to make it meaningful for everyone. And while we have no lack of brilliant Torah, sometimes you'll excuse me, the nitty-gritty of even the refereeing can be a little complicated. I think we all have to have a little sympathy towards ourselves. You are not going to manage a Seder with perfect clockwork. And I find it liberating that it's okay to tell one child, I am now speaking to my Chani, my teenager. I will get to you soon. This won't be long. And then to tell my elders, I am talking to my Rina, to my first grader on her level. And that's okay. It's okay to teach patience to children at the Seder. It's an important skill in life, by the way, and learning patience. But the point is, make it manageable. Keep each conversation short, to the point, but meaningful, and relate to each child on their own level. It's really about them. And I will say one more thing. You know, many Mefarshim quibble how given parts of the Maggid respond to given questions in the Manashtana. And they actually question if every question has been fully answered. And I think what this underscores is the point is actually not really if we answered any question. It's the conversation. What is so gold in the Seder night is a good conversation. We are bonding over that which is most quintessentially spiritual, the founding of the Jewish people, Yetzias Mitzrayim. And if we connect on this level, it's really the connection. I see the Haggadah as actually the lubricant to facilitate that connection of the generations bonding over Torah. It's less what you say. It's less yes, have substance. Marshmallow fluff, even kosher Pesach marshmallow fluff, has little nutritional value. You do need substance, but if you bring substance, which you connect to the Seder, now focus on making it relatable, and it's really the power of the bond between parents and children during this cherished familial time together.
I think that's exactly right, because I think the most important part is that we actually create a loving environment where the children are able to ask their questions. We don't expect everyone to come away from the Seder with final definitive answers, but what is most important is that we at least have the opportunity and the environment to indulge in those questions. Ladies and gentlemen, The Breathtaking Panorama is published by Mosaica Press and is available on the Amazon and Feldheim websites. Rabbi Sclair, I truly enjoyed our conversation. It was deeply moving and deeply enlightening. Thank you so much.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine. May we all grow from this Pesach. May we all grow in all of our Yiddishkeit as a creative, engaging discovery. Thank you very much. Agut Yantif.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You know, Regis brought up the very compelling issue of learning by rote and children who are taught almost as though the textbooks are, I might say, these paros, these dictators by fiat. They are telling you, and listen, don't ask. Well, that is anathema to everything which my book is teaching. I'm trying to teach creativity. I'm trying to teach how we can each develop our own drash mechanisms. That is anathema to what we're developing in a Seder protocol, which is all about asking questions and teaching a child that they have a perspective and they have a viewpoint. If I may say, we are a little bit a victim of our success, and let me explain what I mean. The frum world, the Orthodox world, is thriving. Thriving. Think about the infrastructure, the Jewish infrastructure of schools, Scholl's communities we've brought up, right? Less than 70 years from Auschwitz-Treblinka. My great-grandmother was gassed at Treblinka, and here I sit as her great-grandson, as a Rosh Kol, right? We've built up this massive infrastructure. Observant life is on the rise, right? So we have a certain system which has been set in place of what Frumkeit is. Children, from when they're from a young age, learn a certain regulated, regimented system of Frumkeit, which they need, because the halacha is a framework. It's a real system, right? We don't believe in do-it-yourself tefillin. There's a way to do it. And if you don't do it al pi halacha, you're really not connecting to Hashem through tefillin. And, you know, in Torah study, it's true also. Not everything goes. We don't believe in do-it-yourself midrash, right? So we teach our children there's rules, there's regulations, how you learn, how you live. But the problem is they walk away with the impression that there's no me in the picture anymore. I am this malleable piece of clay just to be made into something. There's no me. And what do you think a me generation in the 21st century America thinks about that? Okay. No one wants that. No one wants that. What we want our children to somehow learn is that, like every all discipline in life, discipline is not the goal. Discipline is the means. Love is the goal. Life is the goal. You're not going to achieve life dreams. You're not going to find self-fulfillment if you don't have discipline, right? You need discipline. But discipline is to find personal satisfaction. In Torah learning, I'm going to argue this is true really in any learning, but certainly in Torah learning, the self in the picture is in a sense the goal. How am I going to make this Torah, this learning, relevant to me and internalize myself, which I would dare say is in a fashion that's a little going to be a little different or maybe very different than you. You know, the fact that at the end of the day, Regis and I are going to understand Yetzias Mitzrayim differently. I have no doubt. I have no doubt. You heard both of our takes, and I'm sure you heard nuances of difference and even just some different neshamas. We're internalizing different, and sometimes my Vart, he'll relate to, sometimes he won't, and vice versa. Because there's a self here. It's my journey. My seminary students in particular, my male Talmidim as well, but my Avreichim, but my seminary students ask me all the time, Rabbi Sklar, what do you mean creative learning? Doesn't Drash mean studying what the Mefarshim say? Because they've been conditioned to believe that all of Torah learning is by rote what has been said already, book learning. And somehow they've missed the message that the Mefarshim are our guide. You know what I would like to compare the Mefarshim to? I would like them to compare them to, believe it or not, OBs, obstetricians. Who is giving birth? Is the obstetrician giving birth? It's not his childbirth. It's not her childbirth. It's the mother's. It's the fruition of her great efforts, her labor of love. The obstetrician is a nurturer, is a facilitator for her to perform, right? My Torah, my life, is for me to perform. It's for you to perform. Our Rebbeim, living and deceased, and our Svarim are the OBs, right? They are facilitating us, and we need their guidance. Don't go out on a lark. You know, anytime an idea is espoused which does not resonate with classic Masorah, I am suspect. But there is so much room for personal and further development within the wide array of classical Jewish thought. I am going to argue, when people ask me the question, why is your book and your Mahalach so important? Okay, it's an advanced creative Torah learning. Why is it so important? My answer is, the personal connection, teaching people that they could do different things with a text than anyone else. Right? I want to give my students ownership, my Talmidim ownership. I do not want any of my students to write another breathtaking panorama book. I want them to write a different book, teach a different shear, which is them. I hopefully demonstrated for them the ability that they could bring Judaism, they could bring Torah, they could bring learning alive for themselves.